everybody. This is Armand Demel.
And this is Roberta Maria Atti.
And thank you so much, Effie. That was
great, actually.
That was well done.
Mm-hmm.
We're here with you with the Positive Mind, Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays at WBAI. Our special on Wednesdays when we try to dig in and find something in research or in medicine or in the field of the mind-body connection, where I have the advantage of Roberta's mind and her research that she does. I mean, she brings me more and more information. Today she was bringing me stuff that I find fascinating.
Well, today we're going to talk about the synaptic self. And when I came up with that title, of course, I realized that, as I often do, I use a way of expressing myself that may not always give images. And since this is the radio, it's not the television, thank goodness there is Armand, who can translate into pictures what I am saying to you, the audience. So when I say the synaptic self, I'm going to hand that over to you, Armand. What is the synaptic self?
Well, I'm going to hand it back to you, Roberta. The truth of it is, as a teacher, as a scientist, as a researcher, you're exquisite. The work you do is great. The classes you give, when you get in front of a class, you could present stuff that everybody gets. When you and I get down and talking, and we start talking about familiar things, like we'll talk about synapses, and we know about synapses, and we'll talk about neurotransmitters, and we know about that. But when the radio audience, who's spent their time learning about things other than what we know, they sometimes don't get it if it gets too complex. So my job that I've always figured is to translate everything from psychology into the way that people could understand it. And I spend my time, my radio time, the Positive Mind, in trying to simplify. And sometimes I oversimplify. Sometimes I make it just too simple. But I really believe that it's important to be able to speak in a language that people can understand.
Never too simple, Armand.
You know, Albert Einstein once said that. He said, everything should be as simple as possible and no simpler.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think there is a too simple.
Right. Well, what I came across is this book called The Synaptic Self. And just the title was fascinating because it got me thinking, well, what does this author mean by that, the synaptic self? And it's a book about how the brain shapes itself, basically, and how it shapes who we are. So I brought it to Armand's attention, and we've been talking about it and looking at the research behind it, and it's fascinating. But, of course, Armand always brings me back to the images and the pictures because, yes, we are on radio, and we do need to give you an image of what we're talking about. Or else it's just words, 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 and more words. So when we're talking about the synaptic self, we're really talking about the emotions, the emotional self. Because let's face it, when it comes to mental health, psychiatric pathology, most people have difficulties dealing with their emotions.
When we're talking about synapses, let's start at the beginning. What is a synapse? A synapse is a neuron, a nerve, a network. You got millions of synapses in your body. It is through the synapse that you have nerve transmission. How does it all take place? You know, how do you, it has an axon, it has a dendrite, it has neurotransmitters, it has esterases. It's an amazing system of how we think and how we feel. It's not only emotions, it's also thinking. It's also memory. All of that takes place through the synapse. Now, let me give you an example of this that's really something you can sink your teeth into. This involves synapse, but this also involves kind of the central of the synaptic system, which is called the amygdala. And let me explain what that's about. When you're in the middle of doing something that you don't like doing, how many times do you do things you don't like doing? You could be overeating, you could be overworking, you could be washing your hands, you could be overchecking doors, you could be involved in any number of things, but you say to yourself, this is crazy, I shouldn't be doing this, how many times have I done this, what is going to be doing this one more time going to do for me? How is it you can't stop? Well, this is not going to be a direct synaptic explanation, but let's start with the explanation of why you can be involved in doing a physical behavior, a thing, walking, dancing, and even though you tell your mind, please stop this mind, I know better than this, you can't stop. Wouldn't it be nice to understand what's going on in my mind? I have the answer, but I just can't do it. How many times do you go around shopping, and you're now shopping, and you're buying things right and left, and you say to yourself, I've got to stop spending money, but you can't. Here's the reason why. Roberta, help me with this, would you?
Well, I'll do my very best, Armand. We have to go back to how the brain and nervous system of humans evolved through the millions of years that we've been around. That's what I always go back to, because that's what shaped it. So many of the answers that we look for to try to understand ourselves today, most likely we're going to find some answer over there. So let's go and look at that. The most important emotion based on the need to survive is fear, because dangerous predators, dangerous things that happen in the environment are the events that can kill us. Therefore, the brain of human beings has become seriously attuned to anything that brings up fear. And the amygdala is the part of the brain that's in charge of dealing with fear, dealing with danger.
Let's get that word, amygdala, A-M-Y-G-D-A-L-A, one of Roberta's favorite names, and I know you got a new puppy. And why didn't you name her amygdala?
Because he's a boy.
And you couldn't call a boy amygdala?
No. Amygdala would have been a girl. No, amygdala is a seductive, you know, I don't know, I always imagine a beautiful woman named amygdala.
Amygdala, center of the brain, little tiny thing.
Almond-shaped,
right? Now, here it is in there. You wake up in the middle of the night, you have a panic attack, you can't understand why. Why is it the amygdala is firing like crazy? Like Roberta says, the amygdala, the center of fear, is the thing that we did for our survival. We have this little organ that will give you fear responses over and over again. It's like sometimes according to nature, it is better to believe a stick is a snake than a snake is a stick. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
It is better that you look at every stick and have a little fear response so that you expect the snake when it comes up, rather than to look at snakes and just think that they're sticks.
Right.
Nature provides us that. So nature gave us this cute little organ called is it an organ?
It's an almond-shaped
I know the shape.
Bubble. Can we call it a bubble?
But is it an organ? Is it a?
It's not really an organ. It's part of an organ.
Okay.
It's an appendix.
It's a thing.
Okay.
Amygdala, powerful thing.
Very powerful. In fact, anything that is compulsive, anything that is obsessing, anything that has to do with emotions that are out of control or behaviors that are out of control, like addiction, like compulsions, has to do with the amygdala. Now, I was saying that throughout evolution, fear was very important because it was a lifesaver. So nature made sure that we had something in our nervous system that would alert us. Even if the danger was not that serious, it was better to err on the side of caution rather than to err on the other side, because that would have been, you know, that could have meant death. So nature made sure that we had something in our system that flooded our brain with fear messages, and those messages would stay there for long enough that we would take action and that we would persist with that action until we were safe.
So let's say that you were on the Serengeti, which probably didn't exist back then, and you hear a rustle in the trees or a rustle in the bushes, and you say to yourself, amygdala says, ooh, somebody that wants to eat you. And then you say, no, it's a nice day. There's nobody over there. Well, the amygdala doesn't want to let you go. It says, oh, no, no, no. Pay attention to those bushes. So imagine if you're out there doing something compulsive and you say to your mind, no, don't worry about it. It's a nice sunny day. The amygdala will persist. So what is the chemistry? What is the mechanism?
Well, the thing is that precisely because we evolved apparently in rather dangerous environments, or let's say danger was not uncommon, the amygdala, even though it's so small, it has connections to every other part of the brain. It has pathways that reach everywhere, and it has access to everywhere else in the brain, so that in a very real sense, the amygdala controls the brain. Now, that's what, as it pertains to fear. So, of course, we don't just live in fear. We have other emotions. But when it comes to fear, the amygdala rules. Now, what we have found is that the pathways that go from the amygdala to the rest of the brain are in very large numbers, as I just said, but not so coming back to the amygdala. So what does this translate into?
So this is very clear. Let's imagine a roadway to your cortex from the amygdala. Amygdala is in the back of the brain, by the way. It's at the brain stem. It's a tiny little thing, right? It has a lot of access. It has like 100 telephones going to different parts of the brain. If it says, I think there's a lion in the bushes, it gets your, the brain sends a message to the brain gets your feet going, it gets your muscles going, it gets your blood going. I mean, the brain is the place that's going to get the information, and everything starts going in your body because the amygdala sends the signal to the cortex, and the cortex sends out all the signals to the neighborhood and says, watch out. Now what happens?
Now what happens is that when the signal reaches, let's say, the thinking part of the brain, the cortex, well, it activates our thoughts, so we go and look for the lion, and the lion is not there, so we tell the amygdala, okay, nothing to worry about, we can go back to sleep. But unfortunately, it doesn't work that way, because now the neuronal connections, the pathways that go from the cortex to the amygdala are very few compared to the other way around.
So you've got a single line telephone going backwards.
Exactly.
But you have DSL, and you've got airport, and you've got every other pathway working towards the brain.
So one sentence that really expresses it very well in my view is, you can think your way into an emotion, but you cannot think your way out of an emotion, or not just as easily. It's very easy to think your way into an emotion, but not to think your way out.
You know, do you ever have this happen? You might know this experience. Somebody does something that upsets you, and you're still upset, and you know they apologized, but they expect you to get over being upset. Again, you know, the apology may go in, but remember this old telephone, you know, which is practically Morse code, has sent back a message saying, okay, there is no danger, amygdala, you could relax. But it's not so fast. The entire brain is already involved in this hurt feeling.
It's not just the brain, it's the whole body, it's the liver, it's the adrenals. I mean, it's the stress response, it's the fight or flight. So you're in a state of alarm, and even though you may realize that this state of alarm is unnecessary, it's too late. The alarm has gone off, and it's ringing, and it's loud, and you can't shut it off. And it's going to take some time before you find that switch. And so what we're what I'm saying here is that this is a dynamic that is actually true for every human being, because this is how we are designed. However, nowadays we have people who have more difficulties than other people in turning off that alarm system, and that's for a number of reasons. One of them could be their upbringing was stressful. They may have some neurological impairment. They may have, you know, a defective communication. There may be a number of factors that make it difficult for them. But what I do know is that it's not an insignificant number of people. It's a rather large number of people.
The piece that we're going to focus on today is not the history, not your mother, not what happened in the past, but we're going to focus on the synapse. Because, you know, the synapse is an interesting thing. When we say synapse, it's a word. Again, it means neural circuitry. It means, you know, there's a million synapses in your body. And part right next to the amygdala is a bunch of synapses, and it's all over the brain, synapses. It's in every part of your body. But what they've learned is that each synapse is individuated, that people not only have different kinds of synapses, but they have different reactions, and that they do different things, and not only that, you could even retrain them. So this is now kind of phenomenal. So phenomenal. It's kind of amazing.
Well, let me say, I think, something else that is important, Armand, and that is that has been so favored by nature, it seems like. Of course, it potentiates an emotion like fear so that you'll never forget it. So that if you find yourself in that situation again, it takes half the amount of time to run for shelter or to protect yourself or to react in such a way that you survive. So there's a good reason for the amygdala to have been given all this power by nature, because it has been a very effective survival strategy. And what it does is it commits emotional states to memory. And not only does it facilitate committing it to memory, but also retrieving it, so that when you find yourself, like I just said, in that situation, it's already there. Now, this is an important thing to say, because now we're getting into what Armand is talking about, the synapses. These are the spaces between neurons, between nerve cells. Each nerve cell communicates with its neighbors through a tiny little gap by releasing the chemicals, the neurotransmitters, the messengers in that gap, and then the neighbor, it picks up those messages, it reads those messages by picking up those messengers, and it passes it along to the next neighbor.
That's a lot of concepts in there.
Well, that's
okay,
what synaptic
gaps are. Yeah, I know, but
let me
just slow it down. Let me bring it back. Good. So what we're saying, back to the amygdala and where we started, right? The amygdala has memory. Memory is very important. And what Roberta is saying is, once you have a fear response, you remember that fear response. So if your father came home drunk and he beat you, it is very possible that your amygdala is going to pick up on the smell of alcohol and give you a fear response. That kind of memory, those memories, and memories are dependent on synapses.
Yes, but this is what I was trying to say, that when the amygdala fires, let's say the image that you brought up, Armand, is excellent, because that's exactly what happens. If we grew up in an alcoholic home, the smell of alcohol could trigger, let's say, a state of emotional fear and panic. Okay, once that state has been activated, what that means is that a lot of messenger chemicals have been released into the synapses, so that all of these neurons are being activated, stimulated, and basically there's an alarm going on, and yet you are very aware on the cognitive level that it's just your imagination, that it's not true, that nothing really that bad is going on. So what do you do when your mind says there's nothing to worry about, nothing really bad is going on, it's just that person had a glass of wine and they smell like it? But your brain is saying, alarm, 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 danger. What happens is all that energy that has been discharged into the synapses has to do something, has to go somewhere. Well, a compulsion is this kind of repetitive behavior whereby you simply do this mechanical repetition of some kind of, you know, act that you might even deem absurd, and yet it allows you to bring to completion that state of alarm that was initiated by the amygdala.
Well, that's brilliant, Roberta, because what you're saying, in effect, is all compulsions, whether they're workaholism, shopping, whether it's hand washing, or even compulsive sex, is a fear reaction.
Yes.
Is basically what you're saying.
I am saying.
It's hard to believe that shopping for shoes is a fear reaction, but in effect it is, because I'll give you a good proof of it. If I smell orange cake, I relax.
Right. I know why. Because of your aunt's perfume.
Well, not because of my aunt's perfume. No, it wasn't my aunt's perfume.
Wasn't it the cake and the...
No, it was actually the perfume. They included all of the flavors of the perfume in a cake, of the cake, in a perfume called Shalimar.
Right.
It wasn't my aunt who wore it. It was my aunt who made the cake. The cake was made of vanilla, and it was made of orange shavings, and it had a particular smell. And when that cake was in the house, it meant everything was okay. So the smell of orange cake, many of you have these smells from childhood. You know, you could smell something. I mean, I can remember my grandmother beating an egg and the way it used to sound downstairs when I would wake up in the morning at 5 o'clock in the morning. You know, I'd hear the egg being beaten. And I'd know, oh, it's okay. We're in this place. That's that sound. There are sounds. There are images. There are smells that say you're okay. And the amazing thing is when you get those smells and sounds that say you're okay, you don't go into compulsive stuff. Feeling okay, feeling calm, does not lead you to compulsivity. You know, if you're feeling calm, it's easier to diet. Feeling nervous, it's harder to diet. So what you're saying is absolutely valid. That there is a way that we get triggered into compulsions by the fear response. But now, does it mean that we're afraid? No, the fear response can get triggered by chemistry. It could get triggered by coffee. It could get triggered by any number of things going on inside your body. Right, Roberta?
Absolutely. I mean,
it doesn't have to be an incident.
Depending on what's been committed to memory, meaning depending on what you learned as your brain was shaping itself, you have stored certain memories that can be retrieved and accessed through similar triggers, similar sensorial experiences, so that if you smell something that reminds you of a situation where you were in danger, the smell is enough to trigger the danger response with all of the stress hormones and cortisol and everything. Now, we know that that's a good thing because it commits to memory a behavior that's protective, that is self-protection, so that it enhances survival. The problem is that we're now understanding for a lot of people, these memories have become so ingrained in the way the brain is functioning, and they have become so connected to daily routines that we get triggered left and right, and we are in a state of alarm, even as our own mind says there's nothing to worry about.
Imagine you're sleeping, and you fell asleep, and suddenly you hear a loud noise, like somebody dropped something on the floor, right? And you wake up with a start, amygdala, right? Everybody wake up, something going on here, right? And then you wake up, and then it's just something simple. Your kid dropped a toy or something like that. And then you try to go back to sleep, and you say, I can't go back to sleep. And you get so angry because it's just not done with you. The amygdala has triggered the cortex. The cortex has sent out all of these messages, and even though you say it's only my kid dropping a toy, it doesn't matter. The brain is going, because waking up in the middle of the night may have a thing to you, a memory to you of greater danger, because some people can wake up and go right back to sleep. But the people who lived with middle of the night incidents, things that happened when you were asleep, will have a greater negative response to being woken in the middle of the night.
Sure.
This is what you're saying about memory.
This is what I'm saying about memory. And I am saying that generally, as you just pointed out, Armand, when people experience these kinds of unreasonable mental states, what compounds the problem is that they get angry with themselves because they feel, they believe that they should be able to control it. And one of the, part of the message that we're giving today that I think is so important is, no, we are designed to not control it. We are designed to allow this alarm to go on for as long as it needs to go on, because that was what allowed us to survive when we were out in the wilderness. Now we want to change that. It's going to take a little bit more time and patience than just simply willing it, because as Armand said, the from the amygdala to the cortex, we have DSL, cable, you know, we have hyperspeed communication all over the place.
I have 1,000 telephones.
Right. Just from the cortex to the amygdala, we have a messenger on a bike.
That's right. It's well done. Hey, you're getting the images down pat.
Not
here.
Bad. That one was good,
I see,
right?
I see a little messenger running through my brain. Now, here's an interesting thing about it. I'm going to use the waking in the middle of the night scenario, right? Waking in the middle of the night. What do most people do when they wake in the middle of the night and they can't go back to sleep? You know what they do? They go eat.
Hmm.
They go to the refrigerator. And why would they go to the refrigerator if they're frightened?
Oh, it makes perfect sense.
That's the perfect sense I like. Why, Roberta?
Well, sure, because if you're frightened, if you're eating, it means that there's no predator in sight.
In fact, you may be eating your predator.
Right.
Right.
If you're eating, you're not being eaten. And that's the rule of the jungle. Right, Armand?
So getting in there and trying, one way of trying to quiet yourself down
is telling your stomach that you're not being eaten.
Yeah.
Because if you're eating something, you're not being
eaten.
There's
no danger. I have some food.
Right.
So middle of the night eating, which is a cause of many people's problems with weight and so on and so forth, can easily happen when you get triggered. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
And one of the problems is you send a signal back to your brain. Let's say you put a sign on your refrigerator. No food in the middle of the night. Right? You have the sign up there. You won't even see the sign when you're being driven.
No, you'll bypass the sign.
You have to put the sign on your amygdala. But you got to make a really tiny sign. It's got to be really, really, really tiny. You have to be the size
and
of
then
a microchip.
And then you'd have to turn your eyes inside out.
To see it.
Right, which would be very uncomfortable.
This is getting silly. And we have so much stuff to tell you about. This is Armand DeMille. With the inimitable Roberta Maria Achi.
I thought you were going to say the indomitable.
Oh, that's a good word for you.
Thank you.
Indomitable. Inimitable. Inebriated. No.
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 Not
no,
yet.
No, not yet. Roberta Maria Achi. You don't like alcohol.
No, I don't.
Roberta Maria Achi. We're here with you at The Positive Mind on WBAI 99.5 FM. In case you just tuned in, or in case you tuned in through iTunes, or through any of the other ways that we are currently being podcast around the world, which I know I keep talking about, and it's a big deal. It may not be a big deal to you, but to me, the fact that we could get ideas and concepts that will help people be at more at peace to every inch of the world and people who would never have access to this information, that just thrills me.
Me too, Armand.
It does, you know, and it may not, man. Maybe I brag about it too much. Anyway, listen, we're going to take a very short break. I'm going to play you a little beautiful music. And when we come back, we're going to bring you more stuff about Miss Amygdala. Right?
Right.
And Mr. Synapse.
Mm-hmm.
You think it's Mr. Synapse?
I'm sure.
No, it's the kids, the synapses.
Oh, okay, right, right.
All right, we'll be back with you in just
a minute. Mr. Hippocampus.
Yeah, Mr. Hippo. Back with you in just a minute. Couple of minutes. 99.5 FM in New York City. It's exactly 1:30. Listening to one of my latest craves in music. The other day I was searching radio stations, which are now available, you know, through iTunes. If you go into iTunes and you search potential radio stations, you can hear radio stations from all over the world that you can hear anytime you want. And I found a couple of wonderful jazz stations. And in it, I found one phrase for one category of music called ambient, A-M-B-I-E-N-T, which I said, well, that must be nice, soft music. And what it basically is electronic music, but it's soft electronic music. And I kind of like it. I could like it sitting around somewhere in the background. And so the name of the particular album we're listening to is called Elemental Chill, C-H-I-L-L, and it's chill music. Well, you know, I want my amygdala to slow down. I want my amygdala to say, hey, it's all okay. And having a little chill music in the background to me, because it's new to me, is nice. It's simple. It's easy. Armand DeMille here with Roberta Maria Atti, in case you just tuned in. The name of the show is A Positive Mind. We're going to talk to you about the amygdala, and it's something very important. The amygdala being... We're going to be talking about synapses. We talked about the amygdala. And synapses being those very things you're thinking about, those neurons, that connection, you know, between the neuron, between the neural networks, and what happens in that. The first place I want to go with this is to talk about the high road and the low road, Roberta. You know, the high road, it said... Studies have shown that there are two pathways. Well, again, now that goes back to the amygdala. Two pathways through the amygdala's fear response can be triggered. There's a fast low road, which goes from the thalamus to the amygdala, and a slower high road that passes from the thalamus to the neocortex and then to the... Oh, it's how confusing.
Well, What that is saying is that the fastest the activation, the longer the effect, meaning that if the amygdala bypasses any other system in the brain and sounds the alarm all over the place, that, and that's the fast road, that means that there's some serious potential for danger. And so that means that that activation is very strong and long-lasting and difficult to call back. The other one is the one that is more slow in the arousal part, meaning that we're not quite sure if there is danger. There may be, there may not be, so it doesn't come on as fast, and it's not as strong, and it doesn't last as long, and it's easier to call back.
So
but
nowadays,
the way that the synapses are involved in the high road and the low road.
Well, before that, let me do this one first. Nowadays, most people are trying to make choices between the high road and the fast road, but sometimes it gets triggered automatically. But the more you slow down your general system, you know, in other words, if you learn to meditate, if you relax, if you can get some easy time, if you listen to chill music, if you do stuff like that, you're more likely to take the slow road.
Right.
Than the fast road.
Well, you're helping yourself through biochemistry, that's true.
And you can actually change your responses. The amygdala has plasticity. It can change. Your responses can change.
Well, think of it this way. Every time the brain is exposed to any stimulus, anything, a sound, a noise, something visual, something that scares you, something that makes you happy, anything at all, the nerve cells are going to secrete chemicals to communicate with one another, to tell each other what's going on. Oh, we have a visitor. We have a friend who's come over to see us. Oh, there's a phone call. Oh, I need to go shopping. Oh, I need to pick up my kids. Anything at all involves the release of chemicals into the synaptic gap. The more stimulus, the more chemicals. So what Armand is saying is if we can find a way in this very stimulating world of ours where we're surrounded with a lot of stimuli, if we can find a way to slow ourselves down simply through the diminishment of the chemicals that are being released in the gap, in the synapses, that alone could make it easier for us to rein in our wild amygdala. Was that a good image?
I like it.
Because it's a matter of quantity. You know, the more neurotransmitters are swimming around in the synaptic gap, the more stimulated you're going to be.
You know, I'll tell you something. There's a difference between being alone in the world and feeling like part of a family and part of a group. Why being alone sometimes is so rough is because the amygdala has to work overtime to perceive danger. Holding somebody in your arms and holding them close and being close to somebody, or even having them in the same room with you sometimes. You know what I mean? Let's say you're feeling nervous or sick, or you have a headache or something, and somebody comes by and they just sit in the room with you. It slows down the amygdala because somebody else is there. It just makes so much sense.
Even a pet can do that.
Oh, of course.
Cats and dogs, I mean,
I need
birds.
When I heard somebody say he was in pain, I need my cat.
Yeah.
Yes, you do, because it actually slows down that part of the brain. It actually changes the chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
And so here, look at the way nature built us. So why are we so... Why, you know, I wonder, Roberta, I wonder if sex, the compulsion for sex, is not just about reproduction, but is about getting some sense of safety from the contact with another human being.
Mm. I think all kinds of chemicals can be extrapolated from sexual behavior. depending on what the person is looking for. For some people, it could be excitement, and for some people, it could be relaxation, depending on what the person's chemistry is. You know what I'm saying, Armand?
Yeah, but rarely does a sexual experience include the sense of danger. You know what I mean?
No, I'm not sure. Maybe not for men. For women, it does.
How's that?
Well, if a woman goes to a bar or to a club and she meets someone and she likes him and she's thinking that, well, you know, maybe it wouldn't be such a bad idea to spend some time with him alone, there's always an element of danger. Mm. You don't know what this guy could do to you. It's so ingrained in the psyche of women that it's automatic. You always have to wonder. Unless, of course, you take martial arts and, you know, and you learn how to protect yourself, which a lot of women do. But there is always an element of danger. So there are some women, actually, I've worked with some women who like that. They get off on the adrenaline, even more so than on the sex.
I know a couple who likes to make love in the sand dunes, so that they're almost seen, you know what I mean? But they like to be in the dunes in between.
But there is something to be said about synapses and bonding behavior, because there are a lot of chemicals involved in bonding and loving feelings and mating and sexual exchange that really dictate behavior around that field. So much so that if you remove, let's say, oxytocin, which is one of the major, most important neurotransmitters involved in bonding, if you remove it from the brain of two people who are together and they think they're in love, you remove the oxytocin completely, they look at one another like, well, who is that guy? Why am I here? What are we doing together? The bond disappears. That's how incredibly potent these chemicals are, and that's why emotions are so important, because emotions really are the cement of human interactions. Without emotions, positive and negative, we wouldn't have the cohesiveness, we wouldn't have the communication, we wouldn't have the exchange that we have. But it's all chemistry, it's all neurotransmitters and hormones that trigger us into thinking that we are behaving a certain way.
You know, you mentioned oxytocin, and I think one of the things, in order to get this clear for people to understand, I'm going to go back to the synapse for a minute, because part of what's really brilliant about this research, a synapse is composed of, and you've all kind of heard this when you went to school, there's an axon, which is kind of the nerve, major part of the nerve, and then there's a dendrite, which are these like fingers. Like, imagine your arm, and if you, not imagine your arm, but look at your arm, and if you look at your arm, from your elbow to your wrist is an axon, and from at the end of your wrist where your fingers are, that's the dendrites. You see, that's the dendrite. And the dendrite have these little fingers. At the tip of the finger where your fingernails are, there's a kind of a thing that secretes this fluid that goes outside of your fingers, outside of it, and creates a bath. And in that bath, that's a neural transmitter. That's a nerve transmitter. It's because of that bath that you could transmit from one nerve to the next. Now, I know this is complicated, but that bath is called a neurotransmitter, and it could be any one of many, many things that will be the neurotransmitter, among which include hormones. Mm-hmm. What are the three categories, Roberta? Do you remember?
Well, we have amino acids, we have peptides, we have different kinds of molecules, and even from fat, some neurotransmitters are made from essential fatty acids. So they're basically things that we get from food. We eat food and we extract amino acids that then we use as neurotransmitters. Some of them are long chains of amino acids, and those are the more complex molecules, but some molecules are very short, like, for instance, glutamate. Glutamate or glycine, these are just simple amino acids, and yet they act as neurotransmitters. Depending on where the activation occurs, the messenger can be called a neurotransmitter or a hormone. So, you know, wait.
Now we're getting ahead of it. Hold on a second. Let's go back to just the neurotransmitter before we go into the hormone or what it could be called. There are three ways that you can transmit a message, and it's very important for you to see first, and thank you, Roberta, for allowing me to do this. The first thing you got to see is you see this chemical coming off your fingernails, and now you have this possible nerve transmission. Once you have a nerve transmission, that means a memory or an activity or something you do.
Well,
the next thing the brain has to do is it has to get rid of the chemical that was in there. And this is magic. I mean, here you do, you secrete a neurotransmitter, you use it up by firing an electrical charge through it, and then it has to be gotten rid of. Now, these are three very important processes.
These are things that happen in the nervous system, and this is the only organ in the body where this happens. Only neurons communicate with one another in this way, and I believe that's why they're considered very sophisticated cells, because they have a highly sophisticated system of communication with all kinds of nuances, and, you know, they use all kinds of nutrients, actually, to communicate with one another, to express all kind of different feelings and different states of minds and different things. But what matters is that, let's say that you have in your life a lot of, you're a very detail-oriented person and you like to keep your things very organized. If I go and take a brain scan of your brain, what your scan is going to show me is that the chemicals that you are using and secreting a lot of are the chemicals that allow you to engage in that orderly behavior. Now, I'm giving the example of the orderly behavior because any behavior is dictated by these neurotransmitters that Armand is talking about. That's how any movement in the body occurs, through release of neurotransmitters in the synaptic gap between two neuron neighboring cells, and that activates anything you can think of in your body, whether it's a conscious or unconscious movement or activity or function.
It's magic. So we have these glutamate, you've heard of, you know, and then
it's
you think
stimulant.
Of the fact, I want to find out the connection. We discussed it. Glutamate, hey, isn't that like monosodium glutamate? You know, isn't that related? Yes, it is.
Mm-hmm.
It's the very stuff they use to put
right.
in Chinese food to make it savory.
Which is why people get dizzy when they eat it.
Because it fires neurons all over
because
the place.
Because it stimulates brain activity.
There's another one called aspartic acid,
mm-hmm.
which is another neurotransmitter. Well, believe it or not, aspartame
right.
is aspartic acid.
Right.
So we have all these things. We have acetylcholine, and then we have this magic. The magic is, once you've used this up, you need to be able to get rid of it. So it's a process. It's going on so fast all over the body. But here's what happens to people. They have a nerve transmission, but their body is inefficient at getting rid of the used up neurotransmitter. Because what we have is an automatic system that gives you what's called an esterase. An esterase comes along and sweeps it out. It's like, you know, after a parade, you have a parade, and then at the end of the parade, you have the sweepers. An esterase is a sweeper.
But Armand, imagine if in New York City we had a parade every day, right?
All day.
Every day, all day. Well, that's kind of like what happens when our brains and nervous systems are overstimulated with all kinds of sounds and visual and TV and people and job demands and family demands and relationships and friends and the telephone and the computer and the internet. And I mean, we are so overstimulated that we produce a lot of, we fill the gaps, we fill the synapses with chemicals, and the esterase has a big job to do.
And often can't do the job, so it turns into gunk.
And it turns into neurotoxins. It turns into waste, basically.
Neurogunk.
You know, Armand,
you like my word, neurogunk?
I like it.
I'm going to put it in the medical dictionary.
Do you know the what they call liver spots? The brown...
Things that you get as you get older and you get in the back of your hand?
Yes. Those are left behind chemicals of that nature that the body has not been able to clean up.
Why they call liver spots?
I guess because it would be the liver's job ultimately to ensure that they are neutralized, but when the liver is unable to do its job, I guess they accumulate. Now, what Armand and I are saying is the latest research in neuroscience points to the synapses, because that's where all of this is happening. That's where all this activity can be accessed and changed if we choose to change it and improved, or, you know, whatever it is that we want to do with it. We have a lot more access to intervene at the synapses than we do in the neuron or in the dendrite or in the axon or in these parts of the of the nerve cell that are already built and in that shape.
You know, so here are the two things that we have available. There are, according to neuroscience, there are willful things you could do to help improve your body. But let's deal just with a moment with neurogunk. Neurogunk itself, which I've invented the word neurogunk, which is this leftover chemicals that are used from overstimulation, and it could be used from, let's say you have a migraine headache, and you take a lot of chemicals to clear up the migraine headache, and so now you're dealing with the endorphins, which get all involved as nerve transmission, and your head, your neurons get all gunked up. They can't get cleaned out. You just don't get a chance.
And then you wonder why you get compulsive about things.
And then the migraine just keeps repeating and repeating because it won't go away. Here's what we've learned. There are a number of things that are nutritionally possible, and we're not going to give you a list of supplements. Number one, most important from what I've learned, is hydration. It just makes sense. If you're going to sweep the streets, get some water behind it to clean the streets. Make sure that you're adequately hydrated, because very often a lot of the things that people do to try to take care of themselves when they're sick are dehydrating. You see? So hydrate yourself, number one. Number two is your favorite topic.
Right. Nutritionally, certain foods like protein and fat are really essential to make sure that we have the, what did you call them, the sweepers? The cleaner uppers?
Yeah. The gunk machines.
Now, I know that eggs have been very maligned, but you know the egg yolk, Armand, is actually one of the best brain foods you could eat? Because it has all of those nutrients that act as antioxidants for the brain, meaning that they detoxify the brain, and they have it has the B vitamins, and it has lecithin, and it has all these things that do exactly what we are saying.
So if your brain gets gunked up, eat an egg.
Egg yolks, especially.
Egg yolks, protein, fat, right?
Good kinds of fat, of course.
Good kinds of fat, protein. Hydration is important.
Hydration, and then movement, walking.
You know, and it makes sense. When you're sick, you don't want to move. So what happens when you don't move, when you're laying in bed in pain and you don't move? Essentially, you can't move along the gunk.
Right.
Somehow it's so hard. It may pay to just lay there and move your arms and move your legs or something, but try to get movement in there.
There is speculation now that's one of the, possibly, how depression, some forms of depression happen precisely because of accumulation of neurotoxins in the synapses, and the body's inability to clean up the toxins leads to dendrite destruction and cellular toxicity. So movement, even just, I'm thinking sometimes when we feel the worst is when we want to move the least, as Armand just said. That's the time where taking a walk could be magic.
If you possibly could. Hey, this is we're just about out of time. This is Armand DeMille with Roberta Maria Atti, who is, by the way, going to be doing a... what are you doing, a workshop at the...
Open Center.
When is that?
In July and August.
Okay, but if people want to sign up for it, they could call the Open Center.
They call the Open Center, right. The New York Open Center, it's called, actually.
It's been great being with you. I'll be back with you tomorrow. I'm going to be doing a presentation about depression that you have not heard. That's about bipolar disorder. And, Roberta, thank you so much for bringing this. We're going to have to do more on this. If you needed to reach Roberta, how would you do that, Roberta?
They can call me, 973-951.
No. What's the website? Can you...
CreativeHealthSolutions.org.
CreativeHealthSolutions.org. And, or you can contact me through email, armand@brainlink.com.
Thank you, Armand.